Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, joined as always by my cohorts, Danny King, a writer for the Film Stage.
Hey, Brian, welcome.
Thank you. and Nick Newman, associate editor for the Film Stage.
Hello.
Got another special show today. We're not going to have a discussion topic. We're just going to be talking about two movies that are out in limited release. The first will be Blue Jasmine, the newest film by the inestimable and prolific Woody Allen. The next will be Ain't Them Body Saints, the movie that made a splash at Sundance by David Lowery. Before we get into that, though, I'd like to remind everyone that you should check us out on iTunes, give us a comment, give us a rating, and you can always get in touch with us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Last week, in fact, someone did get in touch with us because they misinterpreted something that I had said while we were talking about Elysium. So I'll just run through that real quick. They were concerned over the fact that I had said that race was about more than skin color. I thought that my meaning was clear, but in case it was not, allow me to say that the reason that racists hate people of other skin colors is not an aesthetic choice. It has to do with all various types of stereotypes and cliches and assumptions bred from socioeconomic and psychological standpoints, and that is what I was saying. This is an idea that is perfectly summarized in a scene in Django Unchained where Leonardo DiCaprio talks about how inferior the African Americans are and makes this point by dissecting an African American skull and pointing to two nodules. Like, that's not skin color. That is him actually believing in phrenology, which is a vastly discredited science. So, if anyone was offended, my apologies. That was not my intention. Now that that's out of the way.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't think that I would have to explain that, but apparently I did. Yeah, the world is not as simple as it seems. Like, no one makes a basic assumption on someone based on just the way they look. Like, if you were to do any research into the ways that racism cropped up following the Civil War, you would know that it has more to do with people's feelings towards the disposition and character of other races than it does with their actual race. So that's that. Sorry again if anyone misinterpreted my saying and my meaning. But hopefully you've got that all cleared up now. Again, though, we always welcome comments, and even though it was an email that was, I guess, outside of the glowing praise that we had hoped to receive, it's still nice to hear from you fine people at home. So keep them coming. But now let's get into the actual show, and remember, you can always use the arrows at the bottom of your podcast player to jump, so if you don't want to hear about Blue Jasmine, you want to go straight to Ain't Them Body Saints, feel free to do that. Just click ahead. So, Blue Jasmine, Danny, you and I were able to see this movie.
Yes.
Written and directed by Woody Allen.
Yes.
Starring Cate Blanchett.
Correct.
Excellent. Also, Alec Baldwin and Sally Hawkins and a number of other people, Andrew Dice Clay among them. And a weird cameo by Louis C.K.
So, what do you think?
I love it. You shouldn't spoil me so.
Well, why not? Who else am I going to spoil?
He met me at a party and swept me off my feet.
I fell in love with the name Jasmine.
You know, I have never been to San Francisco. I'll be staying with my sister.
Jasmine! Oh, my God.
Look at you.
Your place is homey.
Oh, the flight was bumpy.
The food was awful.
I mean, you'd think first class.
I thought you were tapped out.
I'm dead broke. Really, I mean, the government took everything.
All I can say is you look great.
Oh, now who's lying?
Is there anything you want that you don't have?
Sweetheart, it's beautiful.
When your sister had all that money, she wanted nothing to do with you. Now that she's broke, all of a sudden she's moving in.
She's not just broke. She's all screwed up.
Yeah.
What did you think of this film?
I like the film, just to put some perspective on it really quick. My review was published on the Film Stage exactly a month ago. So it's been a little while, but the movie's actually still pretty fresh in my mind, probably because it's been doing so well in theaters. So I feel like it's been kind of a consistent point of discussion for a while now. And maybe one of the major kind of like art house hits of the summer. And I think it deserves it. I think that it's sort of especially effective as a film coming after Woody's sort of European tour, because not only is he looking at Manhattan, which he has filmed many times before, but he's also looking at San Francisco. And now I haven't seen every Woody Allen film ever made, but I have to think that it's rare for him to sort of build a film around looking at two different American cities and cultures so kind of extensively. So that was one of the things that really impressed me about the film. A lot of my kind of my questions about it, or things that I don't know if they fully worked, are a little bit spoilery. So I don't know if we want to have a brief spoiler section, but my main issue is just kind of, I think the movie kind of lives and dies by its flashback structure. At the beginning of the film, Cate Blanchett is leaving New York, where she was married to Alec Baldwin's kind of investment guy, who ends up getting arrested, and she comes to San Francisco to live with her sister. And, you know, there are occasional flashbacks that sort of highlight how much she's fallen and whatnot. But I sort of wonder to a certain extent if that kind of stunts the narrative, and I can sort of explain that more specifically in spoilers. But overall, I did really like the film, and it's good to see Woody back with a critical commercial hit after the underwhelming To Rome with Love.
A movie that I had forgotten even existed.
Yeah, I had to just remind myself when I was saying that.
Yeah, a friend of mine actually said, yeah, I didn't really like the one that took place in Rome. I was like, wait, no, that was in Paris. She's like, no, not Midnight in Paris. I'm like, well, the other one was in Spain. She's like, no, hey, the one that takes place in Rome, To Rome with Love. I was like, I don't remember that at all. Yeah, I'm really hit and miss with Woody Allen. I kind of find him to be more grating than anything most times. So it's only when he really gets away from the quote-unquote Woody Allen character that I'm okay with what he's doing. Mm-hmm. For instance, Match Point and Cassandra's Dream and some of his older stuff when it hadn't, you know, been used up so much. That being said, I was insanely pessimistic about the prospects for this film. I just could not reconcile the notion that I would have to watch Cate Blanchett just be this neurotic, insane person for 2 hours or however long this movie is. Oh, it's only an hour and a half. Okay. So for an hour and a half. And so I sat down with a particular feeling of dread. But I have to say that I actually like the film quite a bit.
Yay!
Good work, Woody. I there's a lot of problems that I have with it. A lot of problems. For one thing, I don't think Woody Allen's ever met someone who makes below $100,000 a year. So I feel like he draws from just some insane stereotypes. Like, the people who he finds in San Francisco, they seem like Jersey Shore. It's like he saw Jersey Shore and he was like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll just port those people over. But I mean, in terms of the storytelling, in terms of what he's trying to get out of these characters, I think that he succeeds despite that kind of cliched stereotyping. And the narrative structure worked really well for me. It helped to break up kind of the really tense, overwrought present-day action and give us some insight into these characters and where they came from and what they've had to go through together. I mean, Louis C.K. is in it, so how can you not like that? Though, it's really bizarre, because I don't know if... I assume that both of you watched the show Louis on FX.
I haven't seen all of it, but I've seen
some
a fair
of
amount.
There's an episode where Louis, like, he has an agent who gets him a part in a movie. And Louis is continuously saying that he doesn't want to act, he doesn't like to act, and he's not a good actor. But it all culminates with him getting the part anyway, and there's this hilarious scene where the movie is being directed by Matthew Broderick, and all Louis has to do is be a cop who says, like, your father's dead. And he fails at it miserably.
You can't go in there.
Where's my father?
Your father is dead.
Is that seriously how you're gonna say it?
What?
Cut.
Got it.
Cut.
Sorry.
No, well, look, you're telling me that my father is dead.
Huh?
Well, how do you tell somebody something like that? Pretend my father's dead.
Your father or the character's father? Is your father dead?
Let's just try again.
Okay.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
it's okay.
Really sorry.
Don't say you're sorry.
Okay.
It's okay.
Okay.
Okay. Let's go
right.
again.
Okay.
We'll go again.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
You can't go in there.
Where's my father?
Your father is dead.
What is that?
What?
That face.
I didn't...
Cut.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I thought that was the way that I said your father's dead.
No, let's just go again.
Okay.
We'll go again.
You can't go in there.
Where's my father?
Oh, your father's dead.
Cut.
I'm sorry, what did... That wasn't good either. You can't go in there.
Where's my father?
He's dead.
And so every time he was on screen in this movie, even when there was nothing funny going on, I couldn't help but find myself laughing out loud in the theater. So that was weird for me, and I feel like some of the people got tired of me after a while. I really tried to stop. But, yeah, I don't know. Sally Hawkins as Ginger is really quite grating. Like, but again, I think that's just Woody Allen not knowing how to write a convincing person who may or may not be below the poverty line. But yeah, his classism and elitism aside, I had a lot of fun with this film. I think Cate Blanchett gives a great performance, and everyone else also brings their A game. So I would say that if you're looking for a good way to spend, you know, 98 minutes and you're into a good comedy drama, I would go for this one. Nick,
yeah.
You did not see this film. So we can't ask your opinion in case anyone's wondering.
No. I'd like to, but I haven't. No.
Why don't you tell us what you thought of the trailer?
I thought the trailer was okay. Had some nice photography. And
yeah, the
great
photography
performances.
Was pretty good.
Great performances all around.
In the trailer.
Very witty script. I'd say it's one of Woody Allen's best in years.
Yeah, I was especially concerned because, like, everyone says how good this film is. Like, it's been almost universal that people have said this is a great film. And that last time that I heard that shit about Woody Allen was Midnight in Paris, a movie which I despised.
Despised?
Yeah. Like,
wow.
At first I just didn't like it. It just wasn't for me. I thought it was, like, an hour too long. Like, it would have made a really great short film, but it just kept going. And then everyone kept heaping all this praise on it, and then it won, like, Best Original Screenplay, and I just, like, my dislike curdled into hatred. So I was uber concerned about this, because apparently I'm just not on the level with everyone else. I'm the only person I know who likes Cassandra's Dream.
Oh, I like that.
Do you actually?
Yeah, no, I watched it recently for the first time.
Oh,
so
right.
Underrated.
Well, number two, welcome to the fold, Danny. But I was really happy with this. I enjoyed it quite a bit. And like Nick said, as evinced by the trailer, the photography is quite good. And I was surprised because even though Woody may not know what to do with, again, characters who aren't extremely affluent, he doesn't treat them with any kind of condescension. And in fact, in some ways, they are the heroes of this film. So, yeah, I was able to get over most of my issues that I'd usually have with him. So, I feel like he hit this one out of the park. We're going to go into light spoilers now so Danny can talk about some of what he was talking about earlier. So, yeah, if you don't want to hear spoilers for Blue Jasmine, skip ahead. Listen to Ain't Them Body Saints. But if not, here they are. So, Danny,
yeah.
What are your thoughts?
Well, just in terms of the narrative structure of the film, one thing that sort of nagged on me while I was watching it is that there was really never a point in the movie where I felt that, like, Jasmine could maybe come out of this in a positive way. I kind of feel like her character's actions in San Francisco are constantly kind of being dragged down by what we see in the flashbacks. And the movie also in the flashbacks sort of builds up to like a climactic revelation about her relationship with Alec Baldwin. And so at a certain point in the movie, I just felt like we weren't building up to a character change so much as we were building up to like what led to her downfall. So I think I was sort of being overwhelmed by just this pessimism and this feeling that, like, yeah, this woman's life is just like completely gone and she's not going to be able to get it back. And, I mean, even when she starts to, like, there's a subplot where she starts to see Peter Sarsgaard, who plays like some diplomat or something. And, they eventually get engaged. But to me, like, from their first conversation, it just didn't feel like that was going to amount to anything. And the same thing goes for her trying to work as a secretary for Michael Stuhlbarg's dentist man, who hits on her in some pretty creepy ways. So I don't know if you had a similar feeling while watching it, if you ever maybe thought that things were going to turn around for her, but I definitely didn't. And I don't know if that was a completely successful thing that the film did or if it maybe could have been tinkered with a little bit.
I don't know that you were ever supposed to believe that things could turn around for her because she's pretty much her own biggest blockade in that respect. Like, she can't help but lie to everyone and build herself up. There's a great line where she says that like she omitted some truths and like glossed over some things, but like in her like character and her humor, she was 100% like truthful. And it's just like, okay, you're a sociopath. Like, that's not how it works. Like, you can't say like, I may have lied about my entire past, but this is who I am. Like, that's, you're a madman. And I don't know, like, it was interesting to see her try, like really try. But you could kind of see how she, through her vapid and narcissistic actions, kind of allowed herself to just keep breaking and failing. It is one of those weird things, though. Like, she's taking a computer class. She wants to be an interior designer, but she doesn't know computers. So she has to learn computers. And every time that someone said that, I was just like, "What? Who are you people?" Like, and like the only glimpse that we ever get of this this computer class is the guy explaining like the graphical interface. He's basically like, this is your home screen and you have to click these things and that's how you get access to other things. And I'm like, wow, what the fuck? Like, it was just one of those things. And it was like, I have to learn computers so I can get my degree for interior design. And it's just like, it was just weird. Like, every time that they touched on that and like her actual attempts to do something, it just kind of once again broke the verisimilitude of what we were seeing, because it was just like, do people really have to go to class just to learn that? Like, this isn't 10 years ago. Like, computers are kind of ubiquitous right now. And even if you live the most insanely sheltered life, like, I just don't know how you could not understand what a graphical interface is. But yeah, no, outside of that, I mean, I never got the feeling she was going to pull through in the end, and I don't think we were really supposed to.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I think it, I don't know if bother me is the right word, but at a certain point, like, I wasn't really moved enough by her arc or lack of one to sort of, I don't know, to be completely satisfied by it. Like, to me, the most moving character in the film was Andrew Dice Clay, and who plays Sally Hawkins' ex-husband, and he kind of has a scene at the end where he shows up and he just kind of gives this monologue about how he got sort of screwed over. And that was actually maybe the one scene in the film that really kind of moved me emotionally. Whereas the Cate Blanchett stuff, you know, it was like watching a car crash, you know, it was like really engaging and frightening, but yeah. It wasn't necessarily like it wasn't like, and during the final scene of the film, I was like crying for her or anything. It's like, well,
yeah, I don't know that we were supposed to.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, Andrew Dice Clay really is like the soul of the film when you come down to it. I mean, it's just, it's just the way that I think the character is written and performed, but like Ginger, who is the ex-wife of Andrew Dice Clay's character, Augie, like she's so grating, and she's so like, she's the most like white trash, like heckling, get on your nerves kind of person. And I just really like, I couldn't care really about her like struggle. Cause like the guy Chili, played by, what's his name? Bobby Cannavale.
Yeah.
And he seems like a nice guy until she starts, you know, letting Jasmine affect her, and then he turns into like a jealous, you know, crying guy. And it's just like all these guys are great until the point where they meet these women and then their lives go to shit. But yeah, I mean, in that way, I don't know. Like, I thought that maybe she would snap out of it. Like, maybe this would be her rock bottom and then she'd pull herself up. But the fact that she doesn't, I mean, it really doesn't affect my enjoyment of the film.
Yeah, I mean, I actually liked Sally Hawkins more in Cassandra's Dream. She was just like, she played Colin Farrell's girlfriend.
Yeah.
And she was just like a more natural performance. She's very much playing like a type and not, and she's playing it up. She's not really doing a subtle job of it.
No, yeah, here she's kind of like 100%.
Like, actually, Alec Baldwin is a good example of someone who's also playing a very clear type, like this Wall Street tycoon guy. But he actually kind of gives a good performance just in terms of how muted he is. He's just kind of like in the background of these scenes, and he's never really doing that much. But it kind of,
he never really
kind of
goes full Baldwin.
Yeah. So I kind of like that.
Yeah. I've liked Sally Hawkins in basically everything she's done more than I've liked her in this. But you know, what can you do? That's what she was made to play. But yeah, that's about it. Any final thoughts, Danny, before we move on?
Well, I'm glad you liked it, you know.
I'm glad I liked it as well.
Your expectations. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it for Blue Jasmine. You can check it out now. It's in limited release. Let's move on. Let's pull Nick out of the vault. Nick, you still with us?
Yep.
All right. Let's talk about Ain't Them Bodies Saints, the newest film, or actually the debut feature film.
No, it's not the debut.
It's not? What was this
second feature?
One?
I don't know. Some small movie that played at a few festivals. So it's the first movie thing that anybody is seeing.
We could call it his breakthrough feature film.
Sure.
Okay. Yes.
Breakthrough feature film by writer-director David Lowery.
The breakthrough for his mustache.
I was about to say, he of the spectacular mustache. Kind of looks like Bronson. I think we've said that at least twice on this podcast already. Yeah. This film stars Rooney Mara, Casey Affleck, Ben Foster, Keith Carradine, and Nate Parker.
Here's We're big Nate Parker fans.
We are. Massive Nate Parker fans. Here's the trailer.
Dear Ruth, I dreamed about you again last night. I hold your face in my mind. I think about your hair getting longer. I think about your belly getting bigger. I think about our baby girl.
I shot someone. think I shot someone.
It's gonna be okay. All you gotta do is wait for me.
I'm confused, Ruth. I don't know why you kids did what you did. What do you want to do now?
I'm going to wait for him.
And we're back.
So first matter.
Yeah.
Do we all have our own unique ways of pronouncing the title? Okay. Or am I the only one?
I mean, you say it with like a weird, almost Georgian accent.
Yeah.
I could go for Texan. Ain't them bodice saints.
No, mine's much better.
Ain't them bodice saints.
Mine is, do you want to hear it?
Yeah, say it.
Yeah.
All right, give me 1 second. Ain't them bodice saints.
Yeah, I'm just going to, I just got to say it. It's just kind of like, ain't them bodice saints.
Ain't them bodice saints. I imagine it's like a, it's like this decrepit 100-year-old like general store owner in the town where this movie takes place, and he's just watching all the action of the movie from a distance,
and
the last shot of the movie is him staring kind of out slightly off center from the camera, and he just says that, and then it cuts to black.
That is not how the movie ends, in case anyone's concerned.
Yeah.
No, I just picture it as like a man who's in the middle of it, young man. Born in West Texas. Just kind of speculating over everything. And he says, ain't them body saints. Anyway, Ain't Them Body Saints is the story of Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara, who play Bob and Ruth, respectively. And they have a little crime spree. Casey Affleck's Bob Muldoon ends up in jail. And Rooney Mara, who is pregnant with his child at the time, manages to escape jail time. And this is a story of Bob's struggle to get back to her, amongst many other things. So let's talk about it, guys. What did we think of Ain't Them Body Saints? Nick, let's start with you, since you haven't really gotten to say much.
All right. So I am of split mind on the motion picture titled Ain't Them Body Saints.
God damn, I think Danny's that been rubbing off on you.
I think that it is handsomely made and has some fine performances. Yet, I don't think there's really much worthwhile at the center of it. I don't think the movie benefits much from the style of filmmaking that's being employed. It kind of gives the movie a certain air, which I don't think it can really sustain. I don't want to say there are pretensions to it, because I don't know if that's entirely true. But I do think that sort of this, you know, kind of elliptical manner in which the story is told, kind of, for me, exposed the fact that there isn't much of a story to be telling here. And as it went on, I was kind of waiting patiently, because I wasn't really in anguish watching the film. I was just kind of waiting patiently for something more substantial to spring forth from all that was happening on screen, and I don't think the movie ever really got there. It's fine to just look at on the surface, but I think that if you were to dig deeper, it doesn't really yield much that you can chew on. But, you know, I mean, I think that I would definitely like to see more from Mr. Lowry. I thought he was good with the actors. You know, you got Ben Foster, Casey Affleck, Rooney Mara, Nate Parker. They're all very good. And Keith Carradine, too. It was kind of weird that he was in this.
Yeah, I was a little weirded out by that. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. So, overall, I'm a little meh. But as far as mehs go, you could always do worse, I suppose.
Okay. Well, now I regret ever letting you talk. Danny, what did you think of Ain't Them Body Saints?
So I kind of want to start with a little bit of an awkward side note. So I watched the film the other night, and afterwards I went on Twitter, and there were kind of a lot of people complaining about how everyone's been evoking Malick in sort of reviewing and talking about Ain't Them Body Saints. So I put up a bit of a parody tweet, and it goes, Ain't Them Body Saints, : Malickian textures meet Kubrickian austerity in this Fordian tale of lost souls on the run from their cosmic fate.
Oh my god.
So
you son of a bitch, I'm
writing that tweet hoping that maybe 80% of people that read it will understand that it's a joke. And I think the person that retweeted it isn't a follower, so they might have just came across it randomly. But then the really awkward thing is that David Lowry favorited the tweet. So I feel like when he read that, he was like, okay, this is complete bullshit, but it seems like a sincere, like, this kid really liked my movie, so I'll favorite it. Because how can you read that and think that it's like saying something intelligent?
It's like terrifying. That is that's the type of thing that like a 14-year-old would say.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. So I wanted to start off with that because it was, you know, just an interesting experience writing that tweet and so forth. As for the film, I'm pretty positive on it. I think it's probably worth mentioning that we watched it online. I know, Nick, you had a conversation on Twitter about kind of the lighting of the film and how dark it often is. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, obviously not ideal conditions to be watching a movie like this.
Were you sure that your screen was bright enough?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I actually watched this on my connected it to my computer to my TV.
I mean, you can still affect the
brightness. No, I mean, that has like a default television brightness to it.
Okay. So this is one of the problems, and I talked about this during Wake and Fright, where I hate having to review a movie from my computer because I primarily use my computer for writing. And I usually write, you know, in a darkened room because it's, you know, at night and I'm doing it before I go to bed. And I will start a movie and probably get like 15 minutes in before I realize that my max brightness is literally on the last little dot of a meter. Mm. And like, I hate doing that. And also, you know, I'm watching it through laptop speakers. So like, how can I talk about the proper sound mixing? Like, it's really kind of getting on my nerves, this thing that I'm having to do. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean,
that's why,
well,
yeah, I don't know.
Well, Danny. Yeah, so the movie, yeah, I like the film, and I think I liked it enough where I might, you know, maybe catch a screening in theaters for these reasons, because it is pretty much an exercise in atmosphere. I would second some of Nick's narrative reservations, which again we could probably talk about more in depth in spoilers. But from a directorial standpoint, I mean, this is just on a basic level a movie made by a director with a vision. So it's kind of a nice change up from a lot of the summer movies we've been seeing. And it's probably an appropriate movie to kind of transition us into the fall and winter movie seasons. And I think that in some ways the movie almost plays like David Lowry's like audition as a director, or like a best hits reel of what he can do in the future. Because some of the problems I had with the narrative, it's like I was almost looking at the movie just on an individual scene by scene basis. Like there's one scene where Keith Carradine, he kind of runs this shop and these guys come in and they ask him about this pistol, and there's a little notepad of names on it, and it's mentioned that all those men were killed by that pistol. And it's actually a really kind of tense scene at the beginning, because the guys coming in kind of look creepy and about pistols, and that's never good.
Any man asks you about a pistol, you better look out.
Yeah. But it does feel kind of like weird that a scene like that was maybe given 5 or 6 minutes of attention and other scenes were kind of glossed over. So I am kind of a little bit confused by the narrative structure. And I mean, David Lowry has, you know, been attempting to recut the film And he's put a lot of work into making a new cut for theaters, so I'm sure he's probably still a little bit uncertain of how the movie's structured in some respects.
And Chekhov said that if you introduce a gun with a list of names of people who have been killed by it in the first act, naturally.
Yeah.
Yes, naturally.
So, it's a funny joke.
Absolutely.
Continue, but, please.
But yeah, I do think the movie is very impressive as a directorial effort. So I'm happy to back it, to say it that way.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm 100% for this film. I don't know. I absolutely loved this movie. It was fantastic. I finished watching it and then basically wanted to turn around and start watching it again. What are you sighing about, Nick?
Just go. I want to hear this. I want to hear why you loved it. Why you thought the bodies were saintly.
Saintly bodies. I don't know. It's one of those movies. It starts off with this kind of preamble montage. And just the acting and the filmmaking involved, the cinematography, and just the way that it was telling its story, and everything. It just coalesced into this perfect, pure movement that worked for me. And then from that point on, I was 100% on its side, and I liked all the texture of the story, and I didn't mind little digressions and the way that different things were being glossed over, because it felt like a film that was fully in charge of its tone. And I don't know, like it just works for me. I didn't know that I was going to have to be doing any defending. And without knowing more of what your problems are, I can't really speak against them. But I mean, the length, the propulsiveness of it, the human story on display, it felt like a really good novel. Like it had that feeling to it where, you know, you don't need it to have a propulsive through line plot. You just need to be there with these people that you have grown to care about and invest in and see what they're doing. And I loved that. And I loved the music. The music was fantastic. And it helped to build this tone of like kind of tragic, mournful hope that is suffused throughout the film.
Were you not a little, I don't know, someone tell me if I'm alone here. I was a little concerned, basically, kind of like Elysium when it didn't use an Oxford comma. I was a little concerned from this movie's opening title card, which just says, "It happened in Texas." This was in Texas. And I was kind of like, okay, here we go.
No, I actually loved that.
Okay, it just felt very...
It felt Cormac McCarthy-esque to me. And
well,
we
that's
all
the
know,
thing, is
that guy.
It sort of felt unearned. I was thinking, okay, sir, I don't know who you are. I don't know what kind of artist you are, your intentions. Let's not proclaim ourselves right from the...
I just like imagine you reading like Dickens and you're like, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Show don't tell, motherfucker.
That's actually the complete opposite of my point. My point is that Dickens is Dickens.
But you
right?
But if you'd never known Dickens, if you picked it up and you just read it, like,
I mean, yeah, if I grew up in like the South or something.
Oh my God, what what is your fucking deal with the South? Oh, God. I'm saying if you were, like, in that time period, and you're like, I heard about this Dickens fellow, and then you picked up one of his books. Holy shit. I had no problem with that title card. Danny, what about yourself?
I mean, it's actually a pretty appropriate way to introduce the film, because it is sort of narratively dealing in these kind of broad strokes. And I mean, the other thing is it doesn't really specify the time period.
No, it doesn't.
I've been like, most reviews I've read have kind of stated like 70s, but I mean, I had no idea when it was set when I was watching the movie, and I thought that title card sort of fit that spirit. And I kind of like that the movie had this like vague floating sense of time, like this story was just kind of found and then here it is and now it's kind of gone. It's sort of like it has a mystical quality in those title cards and kind of in the lighting of the film that I responded to.
Yeah, that's what I loved about it.
Yeah.
Spot on, Danny.
Also, we touched on this a little bit, but I think this is some of my favorite casting I've seen so far this year. If you look at like the two leads, if you think of like two actors who are kind of famous and attractive, but also really weird, it's like Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. Because they're both not like conventional leading actors in the sense kind of remote and a little bit creepy, like Casey Affleck, that voice and whatever. So I like the choice of them as kind of leading romantic partners. And then Ben Foster is really good in a supporting role. And he was probably, you know, as much as the movie focuses on the central relationship, it's kind of his courting of like Rooney Mara that was the thing I identified with emotionally. And I really liked his performance. And then you have in one scene where Casey Affleck kind of tries to hijack a car, you have Rami Malek from The Master.
Yeah, that was a welcome surprise.
Yeah, that was awesome. And then Keith Carradine, I thought was great. And then Nate Parker, not given too much to say, but he really slips into his role nicely. So I was consistently surprised and satisfied by who kind of showed up on screen.
Yeah, I was surprised because Breaking Bad is back on, gentlemen. I don't know if you all are a fan of that show. But Charles Baker, who plays Skinny
Pete. Did you almost say Charles Barkley?
No, I was going to say Barker.
Oh.
I was still going to get the R at the end, but that would have been weird. So Charles Baker, who plays Skinny Pete in Breaking Bad, is in this film. And I didn't realize that he was the carpenter in To the Wonder as well. So apparently, anytime that you need a weird-looking guy who's the vaguely menacing
That's the
stature,
pistol guy.
Yeah, he's the pistol guy.
Oh, that's why he was so creepy. He's the guy from To the Wonder.
And Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
He was apparently born in Washington, D.C. But he was raised in Hawaii, so I don't know what that means. Anyway, so it was interesting to see him in there. And it's just one of those things, like, I don't know. I really loved this movie. Like, I thought that it was fantastic.
What do you think the film is getting at? What do you think justifies the approach that it's taking formally?
I think, like Danny said, it's this kind of floating, almost eternal story. It's this tragedy that's bred from these people and the way that it plays out. I think that the melancholic, almost elegiac tone of the movie fits kind of the almost faded outcome of the story itself.
Mm-hmm.
Like that opening title card, like this was in Texas. Like it's just this flat statement. And it's just like, this is where this was. Like this is what's happening. Like it's happening almost divorced from time and all we know is the place. And yeah, I don't know. Like it's just an interesting story that focuses on people who I identified with.
Okay.
Yeah. Like what were you hoping that it would get at?
I mean, I think the movie kind of, part of the reason I keep bringing up sort of the construction of it is because a movie I think kind of is, can't help but sort of insist itself when it's designed in such a peculiar way. And it kind of, I don't know, there's it doesn't feel like there's really much happening here that goes past sort of these peculiar ways of shooting and editing and kind of the sort of the very portentous way the characters speak, where it always sounds as if death is around the corner. And then I think
maybe
that
you just got a problem with Southern people.
No, I'm not talking about their accents. I'm talking about the words they speak.
Oh.
Yeah, there's something about sort of, I think the end of the movie kind of crystallized it, where it sort of has a very, to me, kind of a very flat conclusion, sort of a very anticlimactic way of wrapping things up. And that sort of encapsulated the entire movie for me, where it was sort of going towards something, and then it felt like it maybe stopped right before it reached that point, almost out of fear of going any further. And then there's sort of this final scene, which is a flashback to an earlier moment. And it was supposed to be, you know, oh, it's these two characters sharing a tender moment before it all went wrong. But I didn't really know who, I didn't really understand their relationship. It kind of felt like he was relying a bit too much on the performers themselves to try and get something more substantial out of it, which is actually something I don't have a problem with. A lot of movies I love actually rely on their actors to communicate those certain emotional beats, but I don't think that the script here was really... I still think it was a detriment to that marital status. Were they married?
I never got the feeling that they were actually married.
Okay.
No.
Well, they had a child. It happened in Certain Texas.
It's funny that you bring up the ending, because I found the ending extremely effective.
Well, we're just on different sides.
I was about to say. And that's probably an excellent way to segue into some spoilers, I guess, just to wrap up this idea of whether or not the story is worthy of the form. Everyone keeps calling it Malick-like. I really more or less put it in tune with the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Which is in itself...
Casey Affleck wears a hat?
Yeah, because anytime Casey Affleck wears a hat. It's... Malick has this kind of floating, dreamlike, omnipotent, godlike camera. And this camera is more like the beautiful filter of nostalgia and memory. I know that makes me sound like a pretentious asshole, but I don't care. There's definite differences. And just because it's beautiful doesn't mean that it's Malick, and just because it's Texas doesn't mean that it's Malick. So just wanted to throw that out there before we moved into spoilers. Did anyone else have anything they wanted to say before we got into spoilers?
I've over the last 2 years I've become so irritated with the it's Malick-esque proclamations because it feels to me like sort of a very limited frame of reference.
Yeah.
Kind of.
It's basically just saying, like, this is not your average, like...
American film.
Yeah, like,
yeah.
Mid-range, close-up. Like, any time that you kind of step outside of those very formal cinematic standards, you're like, oh, it's like Malick.
Yeah,
really?
Well...
Really, guy?
It's kind of a problem I had out of Sundance this year, actually, when this movie premiered, as it so happens, when people were calling that an Upstream Color... Malick-esque. I thought, well, Upstream Color is more Tarkovsky than Malick, but I kind of thought to myself, I feel like a lot of people who are saying, oh, it's very much like Terrence Malick, I've probably never seen a Tarkovsky movie.
Yeah.
I couldn't help it.
In all honesty, they've probably never seen a Malick movie either.
I mean, yeah, that's true too.
I saw the trailer for Tree of Life, though.
It's sort of like, it's sort of this thing where it seems like, so there's very limited frame of reference where you say that, okay, something with sort of an elliptical manner to it is Malick-esque. Something surreal is Lynchian. It's like,
I should have put Lynchian in my tweet.
Yeah, way to fuck that up.
So I don't know. I mean, maybe I thought I read an interview actually that a friend of mine did with David Lowery, where they asked him about it, and I think he expressed a little irritation with it, to be honest. And I can understand why. I mean, if I was making my breakthrough, I wouldn't want to be constantly compared with another filmmaker, another more well-established, more respected filmmaker. That's kind of not really, it's not ideal.
Yeah.
I think I also read Lowry state that some at Sundance are even comparing it to Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Which I was just going to say, like, this is the same type of nonsense that people were throwing at Beasts of the Southern Wild.
So, like, I feel like
that actually is a Terrence Malick ripoff.
I mean, that's not a Terrence Malick ripoff. again, like, there's that first scene with, like, the animals where it's almost godlike. But then when it really gets down to the nitty-gritty, it's more just, like, almost gorilla feeling. Like, again, Terrence Malick has a camera which is, like, the eye of God. And just, you know, having natural lighting and people with Southern accents and a camera that has free reign over its own course does not make you Terrence Malick. There was not nearly enough spinning in fields in this movie to be Terrence Malick.
This would be an ideal time for Nick's Javier Bardem impression.
Would you like it from To the Wonder, or would you like
To the Wonder.
Yeah, dude, To the Wonder.
Yeah.
Just give me one.
Give you a beat. Get in the character.
You shall love, whether you like it or not. To love is to run the risk of failure, of betrayal. It's okay. A love that never changes.
Now do the monologue from Skyfall.
Oh, God.
No, that would take too long.
Oh, damn it.
That's just the trailer bit. That's not even the full thing from the film.
Yeah, no, it's not.
So classic.
I saw Skyfall again this week. That movie holds up. So let's get into spoilers for the Malick-esque Ain't Them Bonnie Saints. So
the Lynchian.
Jesus. Oh, man. We should have like completely not paid attention to the Malick aspect, and we just should have kept calling it Zeitland-esque. That would have probably pissed off a lot of people. Anyway, so Ain't Them Body Saints. Spoilers. So the way that this movie comes to an end is that one of the many people that Bob has fucked over in his life sends out three men to kill him. And they have a varying level of success. They manage to shoot him, but he still manages to make it home to his love, Ruth. And he lays in her room, dying in her arms, as Ben Foster, who has begun his courting, takes his daughter away so she doesn't have to watch her father die. And as he's laying there, it flashes back to him laying in the car with his head on her lap, speaking to their at that point unborn baby, and painting for her this image of the future. And Nick, you said that you found this to be flat?
Yes.
I cannot agree.
I mean, it's not the content, it's the delivery. I mean, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't think the delivery was very, very effective. I thought the stabs at pathos were nil.
Oh, man, I got stabbed with pathos. Just straight gutted with pathos. Like a fillet knife of pathos. I mean, that scene of him in the car saying this like great life that they were going to have and just believing in it so fully, and the way that he still believes in that, and that's what's driven him this entire time. And then it's got me, because it's a Cormac McCarthy-esque thing to say, but he says like that when he views their future, he kind of skips over everything, and it's him and Ruth, and they're both old, and they're standing at the door of their house that's on this big farm. And they're waving, and their daughter's coming to visit them, and they haven't seen her in a long time, but they're really happy to see her again. And it's almost like that's the vision that he had, and this is their future, and he's happy to see her again, even though he hasn't seen her for a long time. But it's like the complete and utter opposite of the context in which he wanted it. And plus, just like there's a point where he's explaining this all to his unborn child, and Ruth says, like, you know, say more about the house, and he just looks up at her and he's like, I'm not talking to you. And that's just like one of those, it's just like that moment like informed so much about their characters and their relationship and like his commitment to his child and his love for her. And I don't know, I was extremely moved by that. Danny, thoughts?
I don't really have any specific problems with the ending per se. I think if there's one character in the movie I felt most removed from, it was Casey Affleck's.
Is there a particular
Yeah, well, I can try to kind of talk about it. I mean, one of the things that people have sort of been singling out about this movie's narrative is that it sort of begins with the two heroes getting arrested, and that's where a lot of these movies tend to end. And I think that was maybe kind of a drawback for me, because I never really got to know Casey Affleck's character intimately, because he's actually, to call him a co-lead is even a little bit deceptive, because he really is off screen quite a bit. He goes to prison and we hear his voiceovers and such, but we're spending a lot of time with Rooney Mara and Ben Foster. And so I kind of, because you could kind of see that relationship from its beginning and its development, I was getting caught up in that. And with Affleck's character, I was actually kind of confused at times how sincere he was, because, you know, Rooney Mara's character, Ruth, isn't really vague about her sentiments of kind of not wanting to see him, because she thinks it'll, you know, just make things worse, and she wants to kind of start a new life. So I guess I just never really knew how Casey Affleck was going to fit into that. I don't know.
A runner with the last two movies.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a telling point where she finds out that he escaped and she cries.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that at that point she realizes that, like, this life she's built for her and her daughter is going to change, because he's going to expect to be able to come in and be a part of it. And it's just that, like, she also has that great monologue about how she stopped writing him when the baby was born. And it was almost like, you know, she had so much love for this child and she couldn't put it all down into words for him. And she was hoping at some point that he'd come back and he'd feel it too. But, like, it's just this concept, like, you know, she's not living for herself anymore. She's living for this child. And unfortunately, like, him coming back in is a complication.
Yeah. I was also wondering what kind of, like, outlaws they were. Like, the kind of crime they commit was, like, vague.
It seems like they were just knockover artists.
Yeah.
Like, they get their guns, they go stick up someone. There seems to be an undercurrent that Carradine's character has his kind of, like, finger on the pulse of the criminals that are around, and that maybe they were knocking over some bad people. Because when he's dying, he says, you know, I remember the first time I had you and Freddy take a job for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, he's a pretty important character.
Keith Carradine?
Or yeah. Freddy? Scarrett.
Yeah, no. Again, I loved this movie. And I like the fact that, like, you know, they don't have to come out and say certain things like that. You just kind of understand innately what's going on and who these people are and what they mean to each other. And that this was in Texas.
And they are saints.
They are quite saintly. All right. Well, any final thoughts on this, guys?
Hope the next one is something I like more.
Okay. All right. Well, I 100% love this film. I think everyone should go out and see it if they can. Danny, you were also vaguely positive on it.
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, if you're 100, I'd say maybe 75,
okay,
80.
I'm like 60.
So you got a whole spectrum there.
That's a whole spectrum. And no one out and out hated it, which is good, because that would have been a terrible way to start my Sunday. So that's it for Ain't Them Body Saints. That is in limited release. I have no idea where it's going to be opening next, so hit the internet for that. Now let's get on into the things coming out in the week ahead. Blu-ray and DVD. We have Epic 3D, the Blue Sky feature, the people who made Ice Age. We also have Killing Season.
Yes.
Scary Movie 5.
Killing, didn't that just come out?
Yeah, this is sort of astonishing.
Okay, this is really weird. Okay, so Danny, what was the date you saw Killing Season? Was it July 10th?
That sounds about right.
Okay. I saw The World's End on July 10th, right? That film still has several days to go before it opens in the United States. You saw Killing Season on July 10th, and before The World's End opens in the United States, it will be on Blu-ray. that you can buy, watch in the comfort of your own home.
Do you think that's maybe a bad sign for killing season?
I mean,
or maybe just a technicality.
Maybe there's been a mistake on some end. I don't know, but it's very odd.
So. Yeah, no, it's not good news for that vehicle.
Right. I'm trying to remember when I saw The World's End. I don't think it was as early as that, but I have
Killing
seen it.
Season was still young.
It was still had
full
potential.
Of promise.
Oh, man. What else is new coming out? Amore.
That's a little weird, too.
Yeah, which apparently hasn't been out on DVD yet.
So that movie first screened in May of 2012. So ranging from May of 2012 to July of 2013 here.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
Shadow Dancer.
I haven't seen that, but I'd like to.
I really want to see it as well. I've heard it. Was it you who favorably compared it to that movie that I like, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy?
I don't think I've compared it to that, but that's reasonable.
Okay.
Although I think Tinker's better. I mean, it's hard to beat Tinker.
Yeah, I was about to say. I mean, 70% of Tinker is still a damn good movie. And then we got a bunch of really weird re-releases and stuff. One of which I'd like to highlight is something called Castle Freak, which is kind of a cult film based on an H.P. Lovecraft story.
That sounds cool.
That's cool to see come on Blu-ray. And Boardwalk Empire, the new season is out as well. What was that? Was that a?
I'm a big fan of that show.
Oh, okay. It was just so light. I was like, is a squirrel get into your room? So yeah. Any other thoughts on these? Since apparently we're more blown away by actual release dates than most of these. Obviously, I think Amore is fantastic. I have not seen, however, Epic. I have not seen Killing Season. I have not seen Scary Movie 5.
I have to wonder what took Amore so long to hit home video. Because it's not... I don't know. I feel like you probably could have released it at any time and it would do just as well.
Yeah.
I think it'd be smart to release it closer to the Oscars, probably. We're like hearing about it and it was nominated for stuff and people would see it in the store and be like, oh, that movie.
Yeah.
I saw it on TV last weekend.
It does have the massive 5 Academy Award nominations, including Best Picture right at the top.
Yeah.
Maybe the point is that you can never really forget some more.
Oh, Rapture Palooza is also coming out. So there's that, because that looked awful. There's a bunch of really weird kind of old school horror films coming out.
From
Redemption. So like A Virgin Among the Living Dead. The awful Dr. Orloff. The fantastically titled Nightmares Come at Night. So check those out if you're looking for something interesting. Flight apparently is also getting a re-release. I didn't realize that was necessary. But
probably
it's
always, just a reissue.
Yeah, it's always good to see Whip Whitaker.
Always good to be reminded of Flight and its mastery of craft and brilliance.
All right. Well, let's get away from the DVD and Blu-rays then. Let's talk about things that are coming out to theaters. There's The Mortal Instruments, City of Bones, which is the newest film hoping to snatch up the Twilight mantle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyone know anything about this?
I know that I will skip it.
Oh, shit.
Ah, damn, son. Hey, wait. This reminds me. Did Jordan see Percy Jackson in Sea of Monsters?
Oh, yeah.
No, I think he was very disheartened by the critical response.
Well, that's sad. I was really hoping to get his opinion on that. Anyway, so the Mortal Instruments, City of Bones. Let me just read what this says. When her mother disappears, Clary Frey? Never mind, I'm not going on.
Yeah, I think we're done here.
Next we have The World's End, which is the newest film by director Edgar Wright, starring Simon Pegg, Nick Frost, Martin Freeman, Eddie Marson and Patty Considine, as well as Rosamund Pike.
Some other people.
Yeah, there's some other people in there.
Yeah, it's cameos. Don't spoil them.
Lots of carios. Cameos. Carios. Jesus. Anyway, this is a film about a bunch of friends who go to try to do a pub crawl, only to find that their town has been replaced by androids. So there's that. And then we have Your Next, which is the horror film that's been getting some pretty good reviews from what I've heard. And then unlimited release is The Grandmaster. So what do we think of these choices, guys?
The Frozen Ground, Nicolas Cage.
Wait, is that a thing that's happening?
Must see.
That's a real movie?
Yeah, John Cusack plays a serial killer. And Cage is a Alaskan state trooper. It's going to be incredible.
And Vanessa Hudgens is in it.
Yeah. Oh, wait. Okay, well, I can still see it. I can.
It's weird that this is not on the coming soon IMDb page.
But yeah, looking forward to World's End. I guess I'm the only one here who hasn't seen it yet.
Yeah, suck it,
Danny. Loser. yeah, I can. I've seen both The World's End and The Grandmaster. Quite fond of both. So it's fortunately The Grandmaster is kind of getting a little railroaded with its release. It was going to be a wide release this coming week until just last week, and now it's going to open in 7 theaters this coming weekend. They say it'll go wide on the 30th, but I do question how wide that's really going to be. I think the movie has commercial appeal despite being in Chinese.
I mean, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was a huge success.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I have seen The World's End. Very fun. Can't wait to talk about it. Definitely worth seeing, though. And I've heard good things about Your Next, and honestly, I kind of really want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
Really awesome. Anyway, so that's that. That's that for that. And yeah, so let's give our random recommendations of something we've watched on our own, and then we can get out of these people's way. So, Danny, you start us off. What's something you saw this week that you think we should check out?
Oh, well, a few days ago I watched in Orson Welles' picture, work of cinema, filmmaking, a movie.
Continue.
Called The Stranger.
Oh, okay.
And it's sort of unique in his filmography in the sense that I think it might be his only film that made a significant commercial profit, and he kind of made it with the intention of trying to prove to people that he could make a mainstream hit. And I think it's better than that in the sense that it actually does have a lot of his more expressive directorial touches, and for the most part is a really beautifully directed film. Edward G. Robinson stars as a investigator who tracks Orson Welles, who's a former Nazi, to this small northeastern town, and Orson Welles is about to be married to a woman, and so Edward G. Robinson kind of has to like work through the woman to help reveal Orson Welles' past as a brutal Nazi man. So it's a really entertaining film, and especially in the first third and the last third, which has a really neat like clock tower climax. It's really expertly directed. And there's an early scene with Orson Welles and one of his kind of former associates in Killing. And the associate guy has kind of turned religious. So they're walking together in the forest, and the guy's talking about like God being his savior or whatever. And it's like a 4 or 5 minute take. And after each line, the guy says, you can see Orson Welles' face just get like tenser and tenser. And then he just strangles the man. And so that was a highlight. And, yeah, I'll end there.
So definitely not an adaptation of the Albert Camus novel, The Stranger.
Stunningly not.
Can you imagine how many high school kids must get totally fucked over on, like, a test? And they're like, oh, man, thank God, I found out that The Stranger was made into a movie, so I don't have to read the book.
I really like the ending.
Jesus. All right, well, Nick, what about yourself?
Yeah, let's look at the list. Last night I watched a movie called The Godfather.
What is this small independent film I've never heard of?
I actually won't talk about that because I've already seen it. And what else needs to be said about it?
I don't know. Did you like it?
I will say that the Blu-ray looks quite beautiful.
Okay, excellent.
The Coppola restoration, it's called. You can get that for relatively cheap on Amazon. You get two great movies and an end piece, along with a lot of special features. So, okay, let's talk about a film, shall we?
Is The Godfather not a film?
No, it is, sure. But I'm going to go with... I watched a good film called Only Angels Have Wings, directed by Howard Hawks.
Oh.
Starring Cary Grant and Gene Arthur.
Is this like a sidequel to Only God Forgives?
Yes.
Okay.
Has anybody here seen it?
I have not, no.
Okay. So yeah, I've been in sort of a Hawks mood as of late, which I think has sort of been enlarged by the Museum of the Moving Image announcing a complete retrospective of his work that's going to start next month. Yeah, so that's exciting. So I watched that and quite enjoyed it. It's often hailed as one of his best films. I wouldn't go that. I mean, maybe it is. Maybe it's one of his best films, but there are other works of his that I do prefer. Nevertheless, it's very entertaining. Very sort of kind of endearing romance picture that I think the thing with Howard Hawks is that I always have trouble kind of narrowing down what it is about his films that I sort of enjoy on a consistent wavelength. I would say that maybe it's more the thematics that carry over between them in really interesting ways. And so I think it was just kind of fun to watch from that perspective. But it's a good film on its own. I think everybody likes Cary Grant, right?
Love Cary Grant.
Yeah. Sure.
So yeah, I would throw out some kind words for Only Angels Have Wings.
All right, excellent. I saw a couple movies this week. They're things that we've all probably seen before. Just throw out some love for Stand By Me. We've all seen that, right?
Yeah,
not for a while though.
Probably Rob Reiner's best film.
Yeah, it's a beautiful film.
Maybe outside of Spinal Tap.
One of the...
Did he direct Spinal Tap?
I thought he was just the actor who played the director in that.
Oh, you're right. It's Christopher Guest. Forgive me.
It's okay. It's all is forgiven.
He did direct it. I'm looking this up. Okay. That's his best film. It's surprising. I didn't think so. Stand By Me a second. But then again... not many movies are better than Spinal Tap. So
yeah, that shows some great craftsmanship that he's able to make those two movies. Anyway, what was I going to say? So we've all seen that, so I don't really need to say anything about that. Plus, I'd already seen it, so I knew I liked it. But I also finally sat down and watched Moneyball, a movie.
Movie's great.
Yeah, I had no interest in this movie, but I was sick one day, and I was like, "Yeah, Moneyball's on. Yeah, fuck it, I'll give it a try." And I was like,
If only you knew Danny when that movie came out.
Yeah, dude, I went nuts over that movie. Okay. And you're a Sorkin skeptic, but that's great.
I am
great.
A Sorkin skeptic, but I think, luckily, like Sorkin's films, like he loses control at a certain point, you know what I mean? like when you give that script to a director, he can be like, we're not saying this, you know, you should add in this. Like, you know, this is who I am, so I'm going to emphasize this. Like, apparently... David Fincher like sandblasted the Social Network script, and you know you're able to get away from the Sorkin-y Sorkinisms of the Sorkin. Anyway, also you know not only that, but Steve Zaillian apparently did a pass on it as well.
Yeah, so it's I think you can feel his touch a little bit.
Yeah, and wow, what a good movie! Like insanely good. I didn't think that it could be that good. But it was.
Who won? Yeah, was that the year that the guy from The Artist won Best Actor?
Yeah.
Yeah, Brad Pitt was pretty damn good.
Yeah, Brad Pitt was pretty damn good in that movie. And I mean, it's just like it's just one of those things where you're watching it and you're just like, I don't understand how this movie can be this good. It's just this film about this guy using math to make a better baseball team. but it somehow taps into the nostalgia for baseball and then just the interesting kind of, I was going to say inside baseball, but that just seems to the point of, like, you know, how you run a team. And it's just really good. It's just like a really fantastic, well-made, like well-paced, done movie.
And they actually just announced that the director, Bennett Miller, his
he
new
did
film,
Capote.
Yeah, he did Capote, and he has a new film called Foxcatcher. And I think we were kind of unsure of when we were going to see it, but Sony Classics is going to release it in December. So that's good news.
And that's the story of Olympic wrestling champion Mark Schultz and how paranoid schizophrenic John DuPont killed his brother.
Yeah, sounds crazy.
Yeah, I don't know what that's going to be all about, but it's got Channing Tatum, Steve Carell, and Mark Ruffalo in it. Anthony Michael Hall, Sienna Miller, Vanessa Redgrave. Wow, there's a lot of people in this. But yeah, I loved Capote, and Moneyball further cements the idea that this is a director to watch, so I'll be looking out for Foxcatcher. And yeah, Moneyball, man. Who would have thunk it?
Good stuff.
Damn good stuff. It's one of those movies, like, it doesn't, like, the tone of it, it could be, like, maudlin and kind of, like, chintzy, but for some reason, like, the director and the actors, they all really pull it off. Really liked it. Anyway, so that's that. And that's it for us. So, let's tell the people where it could be found, and then we will be back next week to talk The World's End. So, Nick Newman, tell us where you can be found online.
TheFilmStage.com and Twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
Danny King.
TheFilmStage.com, TheKingBulletin.com, and Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin.
You can find me on my personal website, DearFilm.net. You can also find me on TheFilmStage.com and at Twitter at Twitter.com/BrianJRowan. So, ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much. Tune in next week.